Thanks, Philip. So thanks so much to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to be here today and discuss with you the uncertain evolution of massive stars. I really love KITP. Not only I was here for a bunch of years as a postdoc, but also this is the first place where I ever came for an international conference as I started my PhD. This was in 2005, and there was a meeting on supernova GRB connection, and I knew nothing back then about massive stars. I know a little bit more today, but not even in my wildest dreams I could have imagined being here 14 years later talking about the mergers of 40 solid mass black holes. So this is a very exciting time to study the evolution of these beasts, and a lot has happened in terms of observations. And a lot has happened also in terms of theories, and I hope I'll give you a little bit of an overview of what are the interesting outcomes of the synergy. But like then, it's still true today that the evolution and death of massive stars is still an unsolved problem. So why is it so hard? From the theoretical perspective, star evolution is still struggling with understanding important phenomena that occur inside stars. So internal physics, the physical of the shooting, rotational mixing, and, for example, convection, especially in the regime of radiation-dominated envelopes of massive stars, is still uncertain. One of the biggest problems in understanding the final outcome of a massive star is mass loss. And we'll see that while theoretically the line-driven winds are fairly well established, most of the mass in massive stars is actually lost through type of winds that are not fully understood, both from the theoretical and observational perspective. Finally, we find massive stars mostly in multiple systems, and when they're in binary systems, they tend to interact. And this type of interactions leads to very complex physics, physics of common envelope and mass transfer that complicate the picture quite a lot. From the observational perspective, massive stars are rare. More importantly, while we try to pinpoint and understand their internal physics, we struggle with the fact that there is a degeneracy in understanding the processes due to the fact that mostly we observe properties of massive stars at the surface. As we'll see, this in terms of understanding stars, in the regime of lower mass, we have the luxury of being able to probe the inner regions a little bit better thanks to astroseismology. And so some of the, I would say, the new understanding in terms of internal physics came from porting understanding that we obtain in the lower mass regime from astroseismology to more massive objects. And I'll show you how that's been done. Now, the good news is that we live in a special era. We live in the what I like to call the new era of stellar physics. We have this incredible synergy between high-precision big data, in particular I'm thinking about astrometry and photometry, and I'm thinking about Gaia and TESS, for example, and obviously new theoretical advancements, both in terms of astroseismology and numerical calculation of stellar interference, both in three-dimension and one-dimension. In particular, in the regime of stellar evolution, which is still in the regime of 1D calculation, if you want to study the evolution, the full evolution of a star through its long-term evolution through the main sequence down to the final core collapse, we still have to use 1D calculation. And the advent of open-source code like MESA provided a tool for the community to check, routinely inspect and replicate results that were published in the past, and sometimes with interesting new results. And I'll discuss with you some of the exciting surprises that came along with this ride. So without any further ado, I want to talk about the open questions. So this is my personal laundry list of the most uncertain physics in massive stars. Obviously, binary interaction, as I mentioned, is going to be a very important one. This is, at the end of the day, a conference about the merger of compact remnants. And so binary interaction will be discussed, not in this talk, but will be discussed by Natasha, Ilva, and Sylvia later today. And they will discuss the uncertain physics of common envelope evolution, mass transfer, and dynamical interactions. Something I want to mention, though, is that it's important to first focus on the physics of single stars, because even if stars tend to interact in multiple systems, after interaction, they actually evolve for a long time scale as single stars. So basically, they fall back on the uncertain physics of single stars. And so until we understand fully the pieces of the puzzle that entail with the inner physics and mass flows of single stars, we're not going to be able to do a good job in predicting the outcome of even more complicated type of interactions. So I want to talk now about rotation and magnetism in massive stars. Historically, the treatment of rotation in stars has been implementing 1D calculation under the assumption of shallower rotation. Basically, assume that in stars, isobars are well mixed in both composition and angular momentum. Under this assumption, a bunch of classes of mechanisms have been discussed and implemented in stellar evolution calculation. In particular, aerodynamic instabilities, including shear, and rotational-induced circulation, like Eddington's Swift meridional circulation in stars, have been implemented, and the effects have been studied in the past for 1D calculation. More recently, in the last 20 years, magnetic torques coming, for example, from a Sprute-Taylor dynamo mechanism have been implemented in stellar-evolution calculation, which led to revisitation of the final angular momentum content in the compact remnants outcome of massive star and low mass star evolution. More recently, internal gravity waves have also been discussed as a mean for transporting angular momentum in stars. Now, the problem for massive stars has always been how to test this type of modeling. There are mostly indirect ways to do it. One is, for example, testing the physics by looking at the mixing of composition of chemicals in the star, for looking at surface abundances as a function of the rotation rate observed in massive stars. The other way would be directly measuring the rotation rate of compact remnants, so at the end of the evolution of the star, both in the low mass and the high mass regime. And some of the hint that some of these tests have pushed the theories toward is that a large amount of couplings seem to be required, at least to explain the rotation rate of young compact remnants. But only in the regime of low mass stars we are now able to directly test theory of angular momentum transport in stars. And this came from astroseismology. So we're going to do a little bit of a detour in the physics of lower mass stars with the hope that we can port that physics to more massive objects. I don't have much time to explain how astroseismology uses like the oscillation of stars to determine the rotation rate of different regions. The only thing I want to tell you is that there are a bunch of type of oscillation that live in red giants. Those are called mixed mode, that leave us acoustic wave in the envelope and internal gravity waves in the core. The restoring force is the gradient of the pressure in the envelope and the buoyancy in the core. And this oscillation can bring to surface information about the rotation state of both core and envelope. And so as the star evolves in red giants, we can track the degree of differential rotation in the star as the star evolves. So we can then compare the observations to models. And so the model showing here is done with a 1D calculation where different implementation of angular momentum transport have been assumed. And so we're showing the evolution as the star increasing its radius. So this is the radius of the star as the star is expanding as a red giant. And this is the black line is the evolution of the surface rotation. So the star is expanding. So this, the period of rotation is increasing. And then we're showing lines for the core rotation rate under different assumption of angular momentum transport. So the green line is no angular momentum transport, so pure conservation of angular momentum. As you can imagine, the core contracts, so it spins up substantially. Instead, if we assume some angular momentum transport, for example, from just aerodynamic instabilities and circulation, the purple line is obtained. And if we include angular momentum transport by magnetic torques, then much more angular momentum is extracted from the core, so that the core doesn't spin up as much. However, when we compare these to the observation, this is what we find. The core of the stars tend to rotate much slower than expected, and they stay almost at constant rotation rate of about 10 days. This was a big result, and that was not expected, and something we could only do because of the result of astroseismology. Now, this push people to revisit and rethink about the physics of implementation of angular momentum transport. And very recently, the work of Jim Fuller, Anthony Pyro, and Adam Jeremin showed that a revisitation of the Taylor-Sprout instability criteria, in particular of the saturation mechanism, leads to a much more efficient angular momentum transport in single stars. So for the red giants, now it's possible to reproduce and match both the core rotation rate on the RGB as the star is burning helium in the core and as it becomes a white dwarf. This, I think, is a very successful, potentially, outcome that might lead to a better understanding of angular momentum transport in stars. Now, obviously, this is for lower mass objects, but if we assume that the same type of physics is going to apply for more massive stars, the implication is that young compact remnants should spin very slowly, at least for single star evolution. So the expectation would be that potentially the spin of black hole produced this way are very small, potentially consistent with most LIGO-Virgo detection, according to what we just heard. But obviously, there might be surprises. So that's something to keep in mind. So another aspect and another outcome that came from the detection from observation of mixed mode in astrocosmology is the potential detection of large magnetic field in the core of stars. These are, again, red giants, so still we're trying to port understanding from the low-mass regime. What came from the study of some of this oscillation is that there were a group of stars showing some damp oscillation mode at the surface that were not predicted by the theory. And a potential way to do that is having a strong magnetic field in the inner region of the star. So if there is a strong magnetic field, so strong that the Lorentz force associated with the magnetic field become comparable to buoyancy, then the gravity waves propagating through the core of the star are modified. And this leads to a suppression of certain modes seen at the surface. The critical magnetic field required for doing this turns out to be fairly large, on the order of 10 to the 5 Gauss. Now, if we assume that this mode that are damp observed at the surface are a proxy of strong magnetic fields in the core, the picture emerges very interesting, because we don't see any of this strong magnetic fields in stars that didn't have a convective core during the main sequence. So a star that less than 1.1 solar masses, so no convective core, just radiative core in the main sequence, show no strong magnetic fields in the red giant phase. But stars that had more than 1.1 solar masses, so they had convective core in the main sequence, do show strong magnetic field, at least in a large fraction of the cases. So it seems like the picture is that maybe all stars that have convective cores in the main sequence, and that's how our connection to massive stars become apparent, they produce strong dynamo magnetic fields, that they are able to survive the long evolutionary timescale of stars and stay embedded in their core. This is consistent with the theory of dynamo generation in convective cores. And if these fields are deposited in stable configuration, they can potentially be conserved down to the compact remnants. And so a large fraction of compact remnants might be strongly magnetized. So to recap, in terms of rotation, the expectation is strong internal coupling in stars. Strong magnetic field might be ubiquitous in the core of stars, especially if they have convective cores during the main sequence. Now I want to focus on the stability and mass loss of massive stars. So mass loss is probably the largest source of uncertainty in the evolution of single stars. For single stars, there are three types of mass loss processes that dominate the HR diagram. In the hot regime, stars lose mass through line-driven winds. Line-driven winds are the only type of mass loss for single star that is well understood from the theoretical perspective and also studied pretty well from the observational perspective. However, the bad news is that, especially for the more massive stars, the one that might likely produce black holes, the star's mass loss is dominated by two other types of winds. The cool red supergiant winds, which are poorly understood from the theoretical perspective, and continuum-driven winds and eruptions, which are definitely not understood. So I will focus on this last type of mass loss for massive stars. In particular, I want to focus on the regime of stars that are very close to the Eddington limit. So these are massive stars that are called luminous blue variables, and they're known to be unstable and lose large amounts of masses. They usually park themselves in the hot asteroid's instability. They stay there, they're in quiescence, and sometimes they move at constant luminosity, and they heat like this wall at lower temperature where they start losing a lot of mass, and then at some point they come back. From the theoretical perspective, one distal evolution tracks cannot really capture the physics in this regime. The most important reason is that convection that happens in the other layers when the star hits the Eddington limit is cannot be treated in the, under the assumption of the mixing length theory. And so we had to go and try to calculate this in 3D using 3D calculation, including the physics of radiation transport. So this is what I'm going to show you is the result of one of these first 3D numerical simulation of the envelope, stability, and mass loss of a very massive star. You can see we start from an equilibrium from a configuration where we need to we take the flux coming from a 1D model, and then we build an equilibrium structure on top of that in 3D. Unfortunately, no real equilibrium structure is found. Actually, what we find is a steady state where the star actually loses large amount of mass in a very unsteady manner, where large plumes of material are ejected from the envelope. The steady state of this configuration actually provides large amount of mass loss of order of 10 to the minus 5 solar masses per year. Here we're not including line driving, we're only including continuum. So actually this might be an underestimate of the total mass loss of the star. You can see that some of this is a very dynamical situation where some of these plumes are accelerated and actually are ejected from the star, other actually fall back. Turbulence here is ensued by the fact that actually convection starts in regions where the opacity is very large. I'll describe in a second what's the physical mechanism actually providing this picture. So what we're looking at here is a situation where we have turbulence, which is created by this convection in this region, that leads to density fluctuation in the envelope of the star. However, density fluctuation coupled with temperature fluctuation lead to differences in the opacity. So what I'm showing here is the opacity of the star, temperature, as opacity as function of temperature. And you can see that as we move from the inner region of the star, where everything is electron scattering dominated, to region where a combination of species leads to an higher opacity peak, and then a helium, and then hydrogen, you can see that different lines correspond to different densities. So if we have turbulence and we have density fluctuation, you can end up in a region where for the same temperature, we have a much higher density. So you can jump from a line where you expect a very low opacity to a line with much higher opacity. And if you're like 80% of Eddington, all of a sudden that blob will find itself to be accelerated by the radiation pressure and leaves the stellar domain. So this can explain potentially a mechanism of mass loss that is observed in LBVs and lead to a sort of continuum-driven mass loss for these objects. The question is then, how metallicity dependent is this type of mass loss? It relies on the turbulence produced by this ion opacity peak, but the helium opacity obviously is there also for very low metallicity stars. So it's just interesting to run models of this process at low metallicity, something we're looking into right now. So last few minutes, I want to talk about pair instability, since you know this is an important domain of investigation, especially if we're thinking about stability and mass loss and the production of black holes. So very massive stars are radiation pressure dominated, and so the core, the gravity is mostly supported by the gradient in pressure, which is radiation pressure. So photons provide most of the support to the stellar core and the stellar structure. However, you can imagine that as the temperature increase, as the star evolve, you might hit a situation where the energy of the photons becomes larger than the 2 times the mass rest of electrons, and so you can get production pairs. And this happens for a temperature of around 10 to 9 Kelvin. When this happens, a situation of dynamic instability occurs because basically you remove pressure, so they start contracting, increase the temperature, produce more and more electron pairs. So you enter this regime of instability, and the pair production leads to a potentially thermonuclear runaway. In that case, you talk about pair instability supernova, or strong pulsation that might remove large quantity of the mass until the star moves out of the pair instability regime. The most important parameter that determines if the star enters this regime is the helium core mass. Theoretical models of this phenomena are well established, and so for single stars, no black holes between 52 and 233 solar mass are expected for stellar evolution in closed binaries. This is a fairly strong result in closed binaries. So if we're assuming that the black holes only come from field binaries, this is the reality of the gap that you will create in the distribution of black holes. Also, the pair pulsational instabilities might lead to a little bit of a pile-up in the distribution of black holes, as shown in this recent paper from Pablo Marchand and collaborators. So this will lead to this picture for the black hole mass gaps, the lower mass gap that might be discussed by Chris Fryer later this day, and this higher mass gap due to this pair instability and established between 52 and 133 solar masses in the outer regime. So to conclude, I would like to remind you that massive star evolution is still very uncertain. Despite these uncertainties, we expect compact remnants to be to rotate very slowly, at least in the majority of the case, unless some kind of exotic channel evolution is claimed or some dynamical origin of black holes is assumed. And then there are large uncertainties in the mass loss for these big stars. And the first 3D radiation hydrodynamic simulation of this object had been provided recently, so there's work happening in that direction. And finally, the physics of pair instability supernova is fairly well understood and predicts a gap in the black hole mass distribution between 50 and 130 solar masses. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Matteo.
Cool. So if I could get you to speculate even more, one of the popular suggestions for the seeds of early supermassive black holes is a direct collapse of 10 to the 5 solar masses. Sometimes, basically, you have a black hole in the center, which powers things by accretion, whatever. But at that level, some of the ejections of matter you're talking about, I wonder if you could speculate about whether this could be enough to remove the majority of the mass during that phase, or whether it's something which is just far too complicated to speculate on at all.
Yeah, this is a regime that we haven't really investigated, so I don't feel very comfortable into making prediction there. I would expect, you know, some of the same physics that we encounter might play a role, though. So that's something interesting to look into. Yeah.
Mansi?
So I had a question about your LBV 3D simulations. Mm-hmm. What sort of velocities are you getting there, and how do they compare to the amount of material and velocities from line-driven mass loss?
Those are slower. So they're supersonic velocities, but we're talking about tens of kilometers per second up to 100, much lower than the 1,000 kilometers per second expected from line driving. Oh yeah. So the mass loss rate are of the order of the higher mass loss rate that you can get by line driving.
But it's still it's in quite the same low. Region. It's only 5 × 10⁻⁶.
Sure.
Six,
so yeah. So for the simulation it was 10⁻⁵.
Right, but you want something much more than that, right?
We're not claiming that we can explain all the LBVs. Some LBVs clearly lose mass at a higher rate than this. Obviously, there might be other pieces of physics entering the picture. Rotation, there's no rotation here. Binarity, obviously, always in the something to consider. But I think this is an interesting piece of physics that wasn't appreciated before, and I think it's an interesting direction in terms of understanding some of this very interesting massive objects.
Chris.
So Falk, Herwig, and Paul Woodward were seeing some similar things where they were doing helium convection and it got violent and they were seeing outflows as well. Is this Are you seeing something similar, or is it, I think yours are more detailed calculations, but is it this similar kind of, they got it where it could it would keep on doing out, you know, bursts of things, so it wasn't just one big burst, it was, you know, it would burst, settle down again, burst again.
Yeah, so I'm not familiar with those simulations. The important aspect of this simulation is the fact that they include radiation transfer. So the radiation transfer is really the key to understand how this coupling between the flow and the radiation is occurring. You know, you have this porosity and you have density fluctuation that couples with the opacity. I'm not sure that they have that piece of physics in it. So I think it might be a different type of physics involved.
I might ask, so I was trying to understand, are you modeling which of these branches of the LBV again? Are you modeling?
Yeah, so I didn't have much time to explain that, but the idea is that we're modeling. So we had a few models where we both modeled the hot. So these are models, 3D calculation. So we modeled both the star on the quiescent branch and stars on the in basically in outburst. And we found out that yes, we can park them. They can stay quietly here. And then you know if they evolve to this point, so we put them in this region and they become unstable.
They don't evolve there.
Well, the problem is that the time scale for evolution is the thermal time scale too, and that's a little too long. I mean, we can do it, but it's a little bit at the limit. So right now, you know, it will take. So right now, we're basically simulating like weeks to months of evolution. We'll need to do it for a few years to capture the transition from the hot to the cool state. So it's still a little too expensive computationally, but we might try to do it like in a simplified 1D way where we can, you know, move the star on a thermal time scale from one regime to the other using the mass loss rate that comes from the 3D simulations.
Do any of these stars ever become red supergiants? Let me ask a different question. Do you think that 100 solar mass stars ever become red supergiants?
Definitely not solemnly. And potentially, if this type of mass loss is also, as I mentioned, you know, we haven't run calculation at zero metallicity. I think it should potentially also occur. What will happen, I think, is that the turbulence is not created by the ion opacity peak,
no.
But you still will have convection because you eat that into the limit at the higher luminosity due to helium, and then you will do the same with helium and hydrogen. So I think that you might end up doing the same thing, just in a different regime of luminosity. So I expect this type of physics to potentially dominate the mass loss for very low metallicity stars.
Yeah, it's more kind of a comment and a question. You mentioned the gap between 52 and 132 solar masses predicted by Fuslay. I think it should be said that this is only for bare helium cores. So it depends on how you treat the envelope. If the part of the hydrogen envelope can collapse too, this can easily be shifted by 20 solar masses or
absolutely.
So.
That's a great point. So this is a quote from Buzzi's paper. So you're totally right. The issue is like, how can you still preserve the envelope in a binary star that end up merging in the LIGO band.
And you need also a little bit of dynamics.
Okay, exactly. So I think for isolated binaries, it will be hard. There might be ways to do it, but I think it will be a little bit tuning your parameter space. In general, it's hard to park an envelope there and still have all your binary shenanigans that get you to merge without, you know, without removing everything.
So Chris Beltinsky is not here, but he was showing me this morning, he does have one system where it was wide enough that he didn't eject the hydrogen envelope in a binary, and then he had a black hole kick.
Right.
That put
so
it.
You need
so that's how you would.
You need the tooth fairy of the black hole kick getting you exactly into the. So yeah, you can do it. Now the question is how many you expect from that, and probably the answer is not many, but to be seen.
Now, Matteo, you earlier argued that. You think that all massive stars have large magnetic fields. Would that not be a problem with overproducing magnetars? Wouldn't they all become magnetars?
Potentially, yeah. I would say not all of them that do, but I think that my bet will be that it's more common than we think. And the question to what's the implication from the electromagnetic perspective? I think that's a good question and something we haven't really explored, but I think it's good to keep in mind. I think it's, to me, it's more like a provocation of keep in mind that this could be the case, and if so, what would be the consequence, and can we test this idea?
Okay, still have some time for... No? Okay. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. So since it was here in 2016, there was a program, Astrophysics from LIGO's First Black Holes, and I made a number of senior people, including Stan, sign statements which are available here on
Hubble. Yes.
I looked at that yesterday night.
And 64 solar masses was the pair instability in those days, not 45 or 52.
But he changed it soon thereafter.
No, it's true. Okay, I was looking at that document last night. It's kind of hilarious. Yeah.
On that note, let's thank Matteo again.